Recording. And hopefully we are ready. Oh, how can I check that? Should work. Okay, now we are able to start with some delay. Sorry for that, but now we have a recording, a rudimentary recording, but we can still record the lecture. Okay, today we will talk about the rest of the pre-processing lecture. We stopped, I think, on that slide. Correct me if I'm wrong. We talked about PCA and we talked about wavelet transform last lecture, if I'm correct. Can you give me a quick thumbs up or thumbs down? Okay. And we will continue with that. We will get through that as fast as possible because time. And the next thing is we will talk about OLAP today, Online Analytical Processing, which is a pretty quick lecture. Originally, it was designed to be part of a guest lectures slot, so only 45 minutes or so for that. So it should work perfectly today. But yeah, let's start. Are there any questions regarding last week's lecture? Okay, then we can start with the. Oh, one thing I should check. Is there voice recording? Sorry again for that, but without voice, might get. Test, test? Yeah, okay. We can get to our data reduction topic. We already talked about how we can reduce correlation between attributes by using, for example, wavelet transform or the principal component analysis. As I already said, PCA is the more important, the more often used method in our field. So if we are working with relational data sets, we are more often using PCAs than wavelet transform. Wavelet transform is more often used with images or something like that, but can also be used with numbers. As we have seen, we talked about the discrete wavelet transform, and yeah. Something we didn't discuss yet is how to handle string data, for example. Because string data, of course, can be handled by PCA, can be handled by wavelet transform. So we have to get around that in some way as well. One pretty obvious way to reduce dimensionality on string data is to look for duplicate attributes. For example, if we have an attribute name and an attribute surname, or an attribute full name and an attribute first name, for example, then there's some degree of redundancy in these attributes. And we can just select a subset of these attributes to go on. This is a highly manual process. We can, of course, apply some methods to get a subset of attributes that is likely to have redundancy in them, but we still have to pick which attribute to have and which attribute we can dismiss. Also, pretty obvious, we can just drop out irrelevant attributes. Why should we have irrelevant attributes within our data set if we already know that it's not relevant? For example, the address, if we have a big table of students, and all information about you is in those tables. And we want to perform some prediction on grades. Then likely the address, the living address, is not having any impact on that. Why can't we drop that attribute? We do not need that for our analysis. Of course, we have to know that the attribute is irrelevant. Or the student's ID, it's random. It's given to you at a random basis, mostly. So why should it have an impact on the GPA? So subset selection is pretty obvious, but still one of the most important ways to reduce dimensionality, because you can reduce a lot on that basis. However, you have to have some expert knowledge on the dataset. Another way, more automatic way to reduce dimensionality is, it's based on the attribute subset selection. However, it's a supporting way. We can do a heuristic search on attribute selection, because we have 2 to the power of d possible combinations of attributes. Of course, if we have d attributes, we have 2 to the power of d possible combinations. If we go through every possible combination, we can then repeatedly eliminate the worst attribute combination attribute in these combinations, and therefore end up with a good selection. However, we still have to have some way to check that. For example, we can apply a t-test in classification, which is chapter 7, or we can apply other ways to evaluate our methods. T-tests are pretty good because they can be automated a lot. If you have questions, just raise your hand, because I go through those slides a lot faster than usual. If you have questions, just raise your hand. Next thing, we can generate new attributes, which is not intuitive in the first second you think about that, because why is creating a new attribute helping out with reducing dimensionality? You increase dimensionality by adding an attribute. However, of course, you can combine multiple attributes, the core parts of multiple attributes, into one attribute to reduce dimensionality by dropping the 3 attributes and creating one new attribute. Basically, that's what we have done with PCA. We created a new attribute containing the gist of multiple attributes, depending on our selection. We might reduce 3 attributes, 3 dimensions to 1 dimension, or something like that. This is pretty good. This can also be done by Waffle transform. That's what I've written here. However, it can also be done with strings. For example, again, first name, second name, last name, as an example, might be specific dimensions. We can reduce that, create a new dimension name out of that, if we want to do that. Whether it helps or not, in this case, depends hugely on the method. These have been the methods to reduce dimensions. However, there's a certain thing to be said about reducing our amount of data in the rows. So the data we have within our data set, not dimensionality wise, but tuple wise. This can be done by choosing any form of smaller data representation. For example, if we have a data compression algorithm, we can, of course, reduce the data we have to store per tuple. It can also be done if we assume a method, a function out of our data. If you already know that our data set, for example, we do a histogram analysis, and our data set looks something like, so this is our data set. And our data set looks like something like this. When we might assume a normal distribution, because somewhere this is close to a normal distribution. Of course, it's an approximation, but we can assume that and then just save the parameters we need to save this function, this curve, which is of course smaller than to save every little data point creating this normal distribution. This is just an example. It can be can only be done with normal distribution, but of course, if we have a data set, a time series data set, which is looking for something like that, then of course we can do that with a sine, a cosine, curve, or something like that. That's all possible, of course. I guess that's obvious. We can, then can only store the parameters to generate that curve. Of course, it's an approximation. If we have a little outlier, a little noise in there, then we can't store that. It's lost. But we can discard the original data and then just regenerate it using our approximated function. We have to divide in this phase between parametric and non-parametric methods. Parametric methods assume a function, so something like our sine curve, and we have to store parameters. For example, how big the frequency is of a sine curve. With non-parametric methods, so the normal distribution would be a parametric method, but the histogram itself would be a non-parametric method because we just store that within buckets and just count how many values are in which bucket. So we know in this lecture hall there are 6-7 people, and if you do not want to store each of your ages, or let's go with your degree programs, okay? Maybe 4 of you are data scientists and 3 of you are computer scientists. Doesn't have to be right, but just as an example. We can just save the degree program for each of you. So we have 7 lines with a degree program, or we can just save 4 times computers, 4 times data science, 3 times data science. We of course lost which of you is which degree program. However, we still stored the amount of people in each degree program. Because we saved the sum of each bucket. With a histogram analysis, and that's something you should already have done within the exercise, and we have already talked about that during the data lecture, we have different possibilities if we are not talking about discrete data, but we are talking about numeric data. We can talk about the equal width, the width and the frequency of the histogram. And there are 2 possibilities to determine whether we how to design this histogram. Because let's say we have a data set 15, 16, 17. And 19, 20. Let's call it 60. We have 2 possibilities. We can either create a histogram being equal width. Equal width is equal bucket range. We have, and let's say we want 2 buckets artifact. We define it, okay? Two packets. Then creating an eager with histogram would just be looking at the total range of that. So 15 to 20 is 5. And we would create the point, the breakpoint in the middle of that. So 17.5 would be the middle of our value range. And therefore, our targets would range through, from 15 to 17.5 and from 17.5 to 20. And each value in these ranges would get into a specific bucket. So this would be 4 big, and this would be size 2. This is equal to size. And the second option would be to have an eager death part, where we would try, and we should do it like 16.0 and 16.1 to be able to have an easier divide. We would aim to get the same amount of values within each bucket. So in this case, we would have 15 to 16 and 16.1 to 20. These are the two possibilities we can use to create a histogram. Equal depth, where we have the same value range, and equal height, where we have the same amount of values within each, or roughly the same amount of values within our histogram. This has certain advantages. If we want to store, if we want to reduce our data by using a histogram, and we use an equal width, we might create a bucket only containing one, and now the recording arrives. I already created my own recording. come up with a bucket only containing maybe one value, or maybe even a bucket with zero values. If we have a big histogram and great result, we might have something like this, where we have some values in the first bucket, no values in the second bucket, some values in the third bucket. Of course, this doesn't reduce data efficiency. However, if you use equal height, the depth, then we will come up, equal frequency, we will come up with some content for most buckets. So equal frequency is often the best way to save space. However, there might be certain arguments to be made for equal width, even in our data reduction way of thinking. Okay, and our way to do things to save data is clustering, because not every time we can create a simple histogram, we can create clusters out of that. However, that's something we will discuss in chapter 8. I think chapter 7 is wrong in this slide, because chapter 7 should be classification, and cluster analysis would be chapter 8. Another thing to reduce the amount of tuples we have to work with, and that's actually something that is chosen pretty often in the real world, is sampling. Because if we just choose some tuples of original data set and train our model on that data set, it often is not 100% correct, but it's good enough to represent the whole data set. Of course, with sampling, we have to choose a representative subset of your data. If you choose a non-representative subset of your data, then the resulting model will not be good at all. Therefore, we have to come up with some stratified way of sampling. There are different types of sampling, and those are pretty important. The simple random sampling, as you might already know, is of course not pretty representative in most cases. You might be lucky to get a representative sample by random sampling, but you might also be not lucky. That's what random is about. You might win the lottery, but you might also lose. More often, you lose. The advantage of random sampling is, of course, it's pretty easy to do, to perform, and you have an equal probability to select any particular item. So every item is likely to be selected in any run. You can do random sampling also in two different ways if you do it multiple times. Can do sampling without replacement and sampling with replacement. Again, pretty obvious. If you select an item, you remove it from a population. So next time you do a random sampling or any other sampling, sampling without replacement doesn't only work with random sampling, but with all sampling methods. You just remove it from a population and you will not again select it. Or with replacement, there it can be selected multiple times. And I guess we will now start to record. We will discuss how we.
Ja, ist überhaupt kein Problem. Ich habe es auch, ich zeige es halt mit einem OBS auf. Okay. Kannst du dir auch theoretisch schicken, wenn ihr irgendwelche Möglichkeiten habt, es irgendwie zu verbinden, dann wäre es natürlich super.
Super, ja. Okay, give me a second. Okay, and sampling with replacement is just putting our sample, once we have selected it, back into the population and we can select it again. So if you use random sampling together with sampling with replacement and sample just multiple times, we might get lucky and select the same sample for multiple times. However, there is a better way of doing things, and that's always stratified sampling, where we try to partition the dataset into certain groups and draw samples from each partition. If we do that, we can get up with the same percentage of data. However, we have, in most cases, a better sample. For example, if we go with, again, temperature data. Let's do temperature data. And we have a database just saving the current temperature, maybe minutely. Then, if we might have something like this 23, 23.1, 23.1, 23.2, 23.3, and so on, and before that, there are some data. This is a normal day as today, okay? If we do just random sampling, we might be unlucky and get this sample, and this sample. However, down here, there might be some hot bubbles, -1 degree, -1.5 degree, and so on. How is that sample representing both samples? In no way. The stratified sampling, we would cut our data set into multiple partitions and draw one sample, or multiple samples, also possible, from each dissection. And therefore, we would know that somewhere there are other, totally other values. So we would end up with a more representative data set. However, of course, we can still be unlucky and get, for example, an outlier within the data set. That's still possible to happen. So pretty obvious. Sampling, however, and there are more advanced ways of sampling. If you look at surveys, they sample persons out of specific groups, which is basically also stratified sampling, where the population is not divided through just where in the database they are, but how they are defined as a person. For example, we try to get 50% males and 50% females, or something like that. That's also stratified sampling in some way. Or 20% university students, 20% uneducated persons, 20% persons with degree in a Meister in Germany, or something like that. Another way to reduce the data is the data cube. And the data cube will become relevant, especially in the next chapter. We will also get to that today, where we have certain levels of aggregation within our data cube. That's OLAP, basically, or that's one concept within OLAP. And by choosing a higher level of aggregation, we will get to less data to be handled, which is something we will talk about today, and I don't think it's understandable for you right now. So I will get back to that later on. And another thing is, of course, again, data compression. That's something I already mentioned. Even though that's my specific interest in research, so I'm researching on the string compression, I will not get into detail on that today, because there's not enough time for that. Okay, the last subtopic of this pre-processing lecture is data transformation and data discretization, where we will talk about functions applied to a certain set of samples. So we do not have an unlimited set of samples. And these sets are, for example, smoothing, where we try to remove noise from data, attribute feature construction, which is something we already discussed in some way, aggregation, summarization, normalization, discretization. Normalization is, again, pretty important, because we want some specific things to know about our data set. If I'm not wrong, we already talked about C-score normalization. Correct me if I'm wrong, but we already talked about C-score normalization, so standardization within the data chapter. I think we already talked about all normalizations. Correct me if I'm wrong. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Did we talk about those normalizations in one of the earlier chapters? I think in data. No reaction at all. So you can't remember, but I think we talked about them. So let's go through them in some speedy way. We have min-max normalization, where we try to get our data set into, or not our data set, basically our dimension, we do that per dimension, into a certain interval of data. Normally, we would choose 0 to 1,
or minus 1 to 1 as two typical ranges of data. For example, we can normalize a dollar range between 12,000 and 98,000 to the interval of 0 to 1. In that case, we would just take a look at the difference between the maximum and the minimum, and then just take a look at A minus minimum, multiply it with the range difference between them, and get it back into the interval. Basically, we would end up with 0.716 for this specific value, 73,600. If we didn't talk about that yet in the lecture, and I'm wrong with that, I definitely know that there is an exercise about that, so I won't get into more detail on that than this. The big advantage of a min-max normalization is that we know a certain range of data we will end up with, and we will use that range completely. So we know that the lower end of a range will be the lower end of the original values. So 12,000 will definitely end up as zero in this case. And 98,000 will definitely end up as one in this case, because we use that range completely. One big disadvantage of that method is that we can't see, or we can't easily see as a human, which original value is attached to which value beforehand. So just by taking a look at 0.716, you wouldn't know with just intuition that the original value attached to that is 73,000. Because we use that interval completely. I will skip this normalization for now and get back to normalization by decimal scaling, because it's pretty similar to min-max normalization. But in this case, we just divide through 10 to the power of k. The k is the smallest integer, so that our new a is within the interval between below 1. So between the interval of minus 1 and 1, basically. Which is the big advantage if we again take a look at this example, 12,000 and 98,000, because I can directly say to you that 12,000 will end up as 0.12. And 98,000 will end up as 0.98. We do not use that interval from minus 1 to 1 completely. We lose something of that, but we can humanly say what value will end up as which value, because we just move our comma in that. So advantage of min-max normalization is we use the whole interval, while the advantage of normalization by decimal scaling is it's human readable. Basically, this common normalization is some special case, because we do not try to just push that down into a certain interval, but we try to standardize the standard deviation. So we try to get to a specific standard deviation. And that's basically done by using variance and standard deviation. We will end up with something that isn't human readable as well, but is also not within a certain interval necessarily, but has a certain specific standard deviation, which is good for methods like the PCA we already talked about earlier in this lecture. not in this lecture today, but in this lecture slide set. Again, this is part of the exercises, so if you didn't understand that right now, go back to the exercise. This exercise has already taken place, you can go back to that as well. Okay, next thing we want to talk about is discretization. We have three types of attributes, nominal, ordinal, and numerical, and we can, we already know that we might also have continuous attributes. If we want to discretize continuous attributes, we can divide the value range, so get from continuous attributes to discrete attributes, discretization, I think that's obvious. We can do that by taking a look at our original data, split it up into value ranges, and then just put a value into every value range. Let's take a look at, for example, temperatures. I will reuse that example. We can simply say, hey, this is a continuous attribute. Temperature is pretty continuous. In real world, of course, since we measure that, it's somehow discretized as well by measuring it. But let's say it's continuous, still continuous. We might say, hey, we want this discretized, and we can maybe decide every full temperature degree is one bucket. Then we would put every value close to 23 into the bucket 23. And now we reduce noise because small changes aren't visible anymore. And we are also possible able to reduce our data set because we can do what is called run length encoding, where we say, hey, for beginning with this tuple, maybe we have 5 times 23 and just store this first tuple because we know starting with that we have 5 times the same value, which wouldn't be possible beforehand because we have different values each time. There are two ways to do that. We can do that supervised, we can do that unsupervised. Basically, if you are using numerical values, it's pretty easy to do that unsupervised. Because we have multiple ways to do that, we can use binning, which is what I've done here. We can do histogram analysis, which is pretty similar to binning, but graphically. We can do clustering analysis, which is part of the clustering lecture, so later on. We can do decision tree analysis, which is supervised and part of classification, so also part of a later lecture. And we can do a correlation analysis, which isn't discussed in our lecture in detail, but it's basically based on the chi-squared index or chi-squared value we already discussed in an earlier lecture. Let's go to this simple discretization binning. We already discussed equal width and equal depth of histograms. Basically, with binning, it's the same thing. We grade buckets maybe equal width, where we try to get the same range size to the same range size and put all values within that range size into the same bucket. Basically, it's the same thing as here. Histogram analysis just graphically. Binning isn't necessarily shown as a graphic. So we just have buckets and we do not draw this thing, but it's still the same. So if we do equal width binning at these values we have at the right-hand blackboard, we would end up with, and we decide to have two bins, we would end up with exactly 4 values within the first bin and 2 values within the second bin. equal def would be the same thing we have on the right side of that graph. And the spins, we just put these values within these spins, and then we would create one representative value for each of these spins. So here the representative value might be 16.25, and here it might be 18.75. Just the midpoint, you might choose other representative values. But using these values, all values within that bucket would then just be put into that, well, moved to that value, and so on. Yeah. Maybe let's do this one. So here the first one is 18.75. You can do that with three different methods. Let's say these are the original values we have in our bigger example. We can do equal frequency, so equal height or equal depth, whatever you want to say to that, pins. Then we would try to select our value ranges in a way that every bin contains the same amount of values, equal depth. So we would end up with four values within each bin. Pretty obvious. The next step is the smoothing step, where I selected means in my example down there. If we do that, we are doing smoothing by bin means. We just compute the mean of each bin and then just apply that to each value within that bin. Pretty obvious. Or a second option that can be used is smoothing by bin boundaries. Then not every value within a bin gets the same value, but we apply the values of a nearest bin boundary. So since 4 is closer to 9, or 9 is closer to 4 than to 15, we would apply the bin boundary value 4 to 9, because difference between 9 and 4 is just 5, and 9 and 15 is 6. So we apply 4 to that. These are the two most often options for bin smoothing. Of course, with the second option, we have the disadvantage that we will end up with more values than with the first option of bin means. I will skip this graphic because it's basically the same thing with the addition of k-means clustering, which is something we will discuss in the clustering lecture. Discretization by classification can be done with a decision tree analysis, which is something we'll do later on. The correlation analysis is called chi-square merged, which is basically which is based on chi-squared and supervised. I will not get into detail on that, and I will not get into detail on that in the exam, so no worries about that, but I will skip that due to time concerns. Okay, something we can also do is creating a concept hierarchy generation for nominal data. So we know that we have streets within a city, within a state, within a country. That's something that can be used to get on a further level. For example, if we are talking about your address, living address again, we might say you're living at Muster Street 1 in Erlangen, in Bavaria, in Germany. That would be this the very specific address. If we go to the second level of the concept hierarchy, we wouldn't say you're living in the Muster Street 1, We would just say you're living in Erlangen. Next granularity would be we would just say you're living in Bavaria or you're living in Germany. And by going on a higher level in this concept hierarchy, we can again save data. Because we have less countries than streets, of course. I guess that's pretty obvious. This is something we will also discuss in the OLAP lecture. So let's summarize the preprocessing lecture so we can get on. So we also we talked about a lot of things during the preprocessing lecture. 3 weeks ago, we talked, even 4 weeks ago, I'm not sure about that. And we talked about data quality, how to assess data quality. We talked about how to solve problems with data quality by data cleaning. We talked about integrating data in some way. We talked about reducing data with dimensionality reduction and numerosity reduction, so columns and rows. We somehow talked about data compression, not in detail, but we mentioned that. And we talked about data transformation and data discretization at the end. Are there any questions regarding this chapter? Okay, at least some reactions, but that's good. So we can go on. I don't think we have to record anymore because we have a recording right now running. So I will stop my own recording right now when I do not have to switch between two slide sets. And we will get to OLAP. The chapter is named OLAP in short. Long, it's named Data Warehousing and Online Analytical Processing. OLAP is basically Online Analytical Processing. But it's closely related to data warehousing. So we will talk about data warehouses today. We will talk about data warehouse modeling, the design and usage of data warehouses, and how it's used in data mining. Let's start with data warehouses themselves. There's a pretty well-known researcher in the field of data management, so basically the field of our chair, who defined data warehouses as a data warehouse is subject-oriented, integrated, time-variant, and non-volatile collection of data in support of a management's decision-making process. Okay, let's get through the core concepts in here. What is a subject-oriented thing? This is telling us that a data warehouse should always focus on one specific subject. For example, it can, or not one specific subject, but specific subjects. It can focus, for example, on customers, or and products, or and sales. Mainly on data subjects, on subjects that are relevant for decision makers. Why is that relevant for data scientists or knowledge discovery in databases? Because data science is often also focused on decision makers because we want a result out of that which is helping the decision maker to make a decision, of course. And therefore, data warehouses are often used in knowledge discovery in databases. What is integrated? Integrated means that a data warehouse contains data which might originally be out of multiple relational databases, maybe some Excel files, maybe some Word files, maybe some websites. Of course, if we have these original data sets, those aren't integrated at all. They're different, heterogeneous data sources. And with a data warehouse, we try to integrate all these heterogeneous data sources into one integrated data source. If we have a data warehouse supporting the decisions of a university, we might have a data warehouse that extracts, transforms, and loads data from Campo, from your student thesis, which is a PDF, basically, from the exams, into one integrated data source where every grade of you and things like that, and the title of your work, and signature of the thesis and things like that, are all integrated within one integrated homogeneous data source. Data warehouses also are time variant, which basically means they are created for significantly longer time horizon, time frame than operational times databases. Because operational databases, so for example, Campo would use an operational database, contains basically current value data. A data warehouse contains a lot of historic data that might not be contained anymore in an operational database. I don't think that everybody of you was here long enough to know the predecessor of Campo, Mein Campus, where earlier the grades have been contained. And that's a good example for an operational database might only contain the original data, the current data. So my bachelor grades aren't within Campo anymore. That's too long ago. But a data warehouse based on the my campus and Campo would contain all historic data we can find, of course. If we can't find that, that's not relevant. And it's non-volatile, so we do not just refer to the original databases, original data sources, but we copy the original data sources to physically separate the data to be able to hold it longer than the original data exists, of course. So non-volatile and time variant are pretty closely related. There are some different ways to use our data warehouse. One way to use it is, of course, just information processing. So we are just taking a look at specific data within our data warehouse. For example, by using basic statistical analytics or using a query, getting all female students to mail them an invitation to the Girls' Day, maybe. A second option is analytical processing, where we try to get some analysis out of the data. However, not the level of analysis we do in KDD, but a lower level, which is a lot linked to operations like slicing, dicing, drilling, and pivoting, which are basic OLAP, online analytical processing operations we also will talk about later on today. And then there is the highest level of analysis, data mining, where we try to discover new patterns from data, which is something you should learn within our lecture. So we are basically mostly on this level within KDD. A difference you might want to know, because there are two different name schemes, or not name schemes, but abbreviations online with regard to big databases. One is online analytical processing, which is OLAP. And one is online transactional processing. This is OLTP. For you, as a data scientist, mostly OLAP is relevant on analytical processing, because you want to gain analysis out of the data. While a database guy or an IT professional mostly works with OLTP. OLTP is basically the day-to-day operation, so the databases Amazon is using directly in the backend. They are pretty application-oriented, so maybe a web app, maybe a university information system, things like that. We write data into that, we read data from that, we have short, simple transactions, we access only a little amount of records per query, we have a huge amount of users, and we have a okay size of databases. Of course, there are online analytical processes and online transactional processing databases which reach a terabyte size, however, they are less often. While online analytical processing, which is basically data warehouses, is very historical, very lots of scans, less writes onto that. We have complex queries accessing a lot of queries, tuples at the same time. We have less users and bigger sizes of a database. And basically, we would move data from the online transactional processing database into the OLAP data warehouse to do analysis on those data. Because we can then tune our database management system, our database management database on OLTP, while we tune our data warehouse on OLAP, so OLAP. We have different goals with both systems. While with the database management system, we want quick responses. We want a good write performance. Within the data warehouse, we focus on data quality and data consolidation. One thing that has to be said is that often databases, data warehouses are also based on relational databases, but you can tune those databases to more to be more suitable for this database, data warehouse usage. Basically, there are three data warehouse models. One is an enterprise warehouse, which collects all data spanning the whole organization. Of course, if you remember the Inman definition of data warehouses, we want to be subject-oriented. In this case, the organization would be the subject we focus our data warehouse on. A data mart is the next kind of data warehouse, where we focus on a subset of corporate-wide data, which is relevant for a specific subset group of users. This data mart often, and in most cases, contains only very specific summarized data. For example, I have a colleague researching on data marts for Siemens, and they want to offer data marts to specific company subsections, where these company subsections might receive summarized values of the gas turbines of Siemens. Or they might receive some business performance data out of a data mart. But we have very specific group of users. Of course, gas turbines are more relevant to engineers, values of data, gas turbines, while performance data, business performance data, is more relevant to business people. Pretty obvious. And then we have a data, virtual warehouse, which is basically against the non-volatile principle in the Inman definition, because a virtual warehouse is just applying views over operational databases. So basically, we have a specific query. A view is often just a query, which is saved over an operational database. You can materialize, you can have non-materialized views. However, of course, that comes with a lot of performance implications. But if we know that this virtual warehouse is only sometimes used, it might be the most efficient way to do things. Something that I already mentioned on one previous slide, but it's pretty important, is the ETL process, the extract, transform, load process. Because we already talked about integrated data, the data warehouse contains integrated data from multiple data sources. How can we do that? How can we get from a non-homogeneous source, heterogeneous data sources, into one integrated data source? That can be done by using the extract step, where we get the data from these heterogeneous external sources. Then the next step, and that's why we have that OLAP lecture right behind the pre-processing lecture, is to clean the data. We try to detect, for example, errors in the data and try to rectify them if possible. Or we try to detect outliers, which are not necessarily errors, and try to handle them. And we basically try to ensure data quality in the clean step. Then we transform the data from the original format to the new format of a warehouse. If we have, for example, we have a non-relational data source, like a Word file, Microsoft Word file, where we extracted the data from, then we, of course, have to transform the data to get to a relational data format of our data warehouse. Mostly relational in the back, we can have other data warehouses, but to the data warehouse format, which is the next step. Then we load the data, which is basically doing some operations to ensure working on the data is has some performance, where we, for example, sort the data, we summarize the data, we consolidate data, we try to compute views, if you have views on that. We again check integrity, not again, this can't be done in clean data because we do not have access to already existing data. And we build indices and partitions, which is basically data warehouse maintenance. Um, And the next step is basically to refresh data, because we can't do that just one time. We want the data of the daily usage of the OLTP systems as well. So we always have to refresh our data warehouse to be on par. This is basically the ELTP process. ETL process. Very important, the clean step and the refresh step are also important, even if they aren't part of the abbreviation. That's something very important. Also, the refresh step is basically all the previous steps repeated. Within a data warehouse, and that's something I will go through quickly, we can, of course, not only have the base data, so the clean, the lowest level, lowest granularity of data, we can also have metadata, which is basically data about data. We can have three kinds of metadata. We can have business metadata, we can have process execution metadata, and we can have technical metadata. Business metadata can, for example, be data ownership. Who owns the data set, the specific data set? Who owns the temperature values? Which is important if there are problems within our data warehouse. So we can go to a data owner and ask them how these noises occur or things like that. But also for the data, for the business data ownership, it's important that, for example, a data engineer can't just access data on the money her coworkers earn. So it's also something might not be accessible for some people. We have the process execution metadata, where we have some, for example, data cleaning specifications, where some things on the cleaning process are specified. For example, it might happen that genders are abbreviated during the data cleaning process. That might be a metadata for a specific thing, to not end up with male and female and M and F within the same database, but have it integrated. And there are some technical metadata, for example, which attributes which table should contain. I just used one example for each sections, each type. If you have questions regarding one of them, you can ask them, ask me that later on. Basically, here's the process again. We have original data sources. It might be in RAP, we might have in CRM, and we then will perform the extract transform load process, get to a data warehouse. This data warehouse might be split up into different data marts with specific subjects, for example, the business, the technical, and so on, subject, and there we can base analysis on these data marts. Are there any questions regarding these slides? Okay. Then we can get to data warehouse modeling. Something very important is that a data warehouse is a multi-dimensional data model. So most often we would view a data warehouse in a multi-dimensional view. Maybe I should use a new blackboard. Most often, because it's the last thing we can draw, we would think about a data warehouse in a three-dimensional way, or discuss that in a three-dimensional way, so a data cube. For example, we can have age as one dimension, we can have gender as one dimension, and we can have What is a good dimension as well?
Hair color is a dimension.
Not the best dimension, but gender is a good dimension as well. So let's go with that. We have three dimensions. Of course, this one is missing. And within that data cube, we can think of one tuple. So we have a tuple of a person, age 18, male, and black hair. Somewhere as a little dot within that data cube. So age might be 0, 1, 18. Gender might be male, and hair color might be black. And then there's just a little dot within the data cube that is representing that specific sample. Within a data cube, you wouldn't think about specific single data entries. But you would think about multiple of these data entries, because everywhere within that data cube, we have values. And to these values, we can attach certain non-dimensional values. For example, we might have, I don't know any, let's do GPA. Let's go with 3.0. And if we have multiple things and we just select a little subset, maybe all males in the age range between 16 and 20, with the hair colors black and brown, for example. Okay, that would be this thing. There are a lot of dots in here. Then we can compute the average, for example, of a GPA for every entry within that group of things. Because GPA is a non-dimensional fact, we can aggregate that, and we would end up with maybe the GPA of 2.5, whatever. Random values, again. And we would not think about single tuples, but we would think about multiple tuples. We, of course, have n dimensions. In this case, we have only three dimensions, but in the real world, we would have a lot more dimensions. I just can't draw that. I skipped that. We have dimension tables. So we have dimensions, age, gender, and hair color in my example, and we have facts which contain measures. For example, GPA or dollars sold in this example. These facts can be aggregated and represent the samples that are within a certain area, within the n-dimensional base cube. One very important thing is that we can reduce our cube to certain dimensions. For example, we can take a look at all dimensions, but we can also look at one specific dimension. We can just say, hey, give me the average GPA of every male. That would be just one dimension sliced. That's a slice operation. We will talk about that later. Hopefully, I'm not sure about that. Or we can take a look at another dimension in this thing, the item, but let's go with my example. We take a look at just the 16 to 18 year olds and compute the gender out of them and so on. We can also take a look at a combination of two things and do a dice out of them, where we take a look at a specific gender and age combination. That's possible. Or we can go to our next keyword. So we do not have to limit every dimension, but we can limit every combination of these things. And we will end up with a specific cuboid, so a specific subset of these things. This is, let's go this way. We can limit it in any way. One thing we didn't discuss yet is how to model this cuboid or this cube to a relational database, for example. Because we can't just draw a cube and throw data values in that within our database. And that's basically the last thing we will do today, and the rest is something we will discuss on Monday because, time. We have two main things first. Factor cancellations are the next thing we will discuss after that. But let's go with star schemas and snowflake schemas first. A star schema is basically we create one central table where we have all facts. This fact table contains, for example, in our example down here, the GPA. But it also contains 4M keys to a table for each dimension. So in our example, age, hair color, and gender. If you not only have three dimensions, but we have five dimensions, this somehow looks like a very badly drawn star, therefore we have a star schema. Okay? That's basically why it's called star schema. Very important, in this star schema, we have only one table per dimension. But we can also create a snowflake schema, which is something I can show you in this example, because there is no specific hierarchy within that thing. But if we go with something like a date, we have a day, which is smaller than a month, which is smaller than a year, we have a hierarchy. And that would build the dimension time. Pretty obvious, I guess. Then we can create something that is called a snowflake schema, where we have also a fact table in the middle. And we have a foreign key to the dimension. However, within a snowflake schema, we would create one table for each granularity level of that hierarchy. And if we now have something that is within a hierarchy like that, we might have also a we might have something other than month that is above that day thing, then we can also have deviations within that hierarchy. These dimensions lead to the snowflake schema looking like a snowflake, these little spray things, or at least a snowflake like we draw it today. In database language, and basically we ask you to have some database knowledge, so I will not go into detail on that. We have a non-normalized star schema and a normalized fact schema, a normalized snowflake schema. So snowflake schemas are basically the normalized version of a star schema. If you do not know how to normalize databases, that's something I would ask you to look up, because I can do that within our lecture today. It's not important for the exam, of course, how to normalize things, but to understand these things, it might be helpful. Let's go with a more sophisticated example. Let's go with business type of star schema. In the middle, we have a fact table with four end keys to each of our four dimensions, and three facts. Units sold, dollar sold, average sales. These are things we can aggregate. And in the star schema, we have one table per dimension. So time, item, location, branch. Within the snowflake schema, we can divide some dimensions into a hierarchy. Location and city are created. Time is something we should also normalize in a normal snowflake schema, but then the slides would have been too full. Therefore, time is not normalized in this example. In some literature, it's not necessary to normalize all tables to get to a snowflake schema. Some literature defines a snowflake schema to be fully normalized. That's a discussion I won't get into. If we have some normalization, we are in somewhat of a normal snowflake schema, but as soon as everything is normalized, we are in a complete snowflake schema. And the last thing we skipped, and that's the last thing I will talk about, is effect constellation. Effect constellation is basically using the same dimensionality tables in multiple fact tables, so basically merging multiple cubes in regard to their dimensions, reusing dimensions to reduce redundancy. We will go on that slide set on Monday with a concept hierarchy. 3 days is something I'm pretty confident in that I will remember. Please remember me as well on Monday. However, we couldn't get through that thing. Sorry for that. Yeah, have a nice weekend. Have a nice rest Friday, and we will see us again on Monday at the usual time, 10 a.m. Okay, thanks.